It was quite a cold night, especially after midnight, and that particular person was shivering uncontrollably. They decided then to transport him, as we heard, to St. James's, and we came across a lot more people like that.
Now, the next call you want to tell me about involved a suspected drugs overdose.
That's right. Some work colleagues were on a night out, and one of them was clearly in what the paramedics termed was an altered state, and this proved a huge challenge for the frontline officers.
All right, I'm just setting up to take a blood sugar. We've yet to ascertain what exactly is wrong with this guy, but he definitely has altered mental status. It appears that he's more than likely, as I said, based on my hunch, either taken voluntarily, inadvertently, had some sort of amphetamine-based drug.
And the trolley is coming here now, so you're obviously...
Yeah, so we're going to try and get him off the street, into the back of the ambulance, where we can really work him up, do a primary, secondary on him. What sort of verbal response are you getting there, Carl?
I'm asking him what he's taking, and basically he's just not making any sense. He's not acknowledging his own name. This is the ambulance crew here. Someone was a bit concerned about you. They called an ambulance. We're going to run you up to hospital, get you looked after.
Okay, so we've just got back into the vehicle, and that young man has been admitted. You didn't have much success in finding out what he'd taken or if he had taken something.
No, like in circumstance like that, where this chap has been out since 6 o'clock this evening, met his work colleagues earlier on.
I was observing him for a few minutes there, and he was using his shoe as a phone.
Yeah, and he was using his shoe as a phone. He was licking an imaginary 99 ice cream at one stage in the back of the ambulance on the way up. He was handing me the phone, which was his shoe. He couldn't talk. His pupils were extremely dilated. Putting a drip into his arm was probably going to be futile, because you were going to end up, he would have pulled it out. It is very difficult, and I suppose in some respects we were quite lucky, because we're only 5 minutes from the hospital. But trying to manage him for any longer could have been quite difficult. And like some of the ones that we would have seen before, he was a nice, agitated, he wasn't violent, he wasn't aggressive, he wasn't trying to bite you, he wasn't trying to damage the back of the ambulance. They can be violent, they can be, rather than lip smacking, they want to bite you. And they're extremely difficult to manage.
And you're talking presumably about able-bodied men there looking after the people at the initial point of contact. But you'd have to think about the poor unfortunate staff then working in the emergency departments once the ambulance gets to James's or wherever it's going to in Dublin.
Absolutely. And as I said, he was quite manageable, that particular patient. But I think that, you know, they suspected it was a combination of four different types of drugs. They just didn't know. I suppose the synthetic types of drugs are having such a huge impact.
That phrase, Brian, and I think it's cropped up at least three times in the report so far, altered mental status, is a euphemism, I suppose, that covers basically being out of it on drugs or drink.
Well, I'd never seen someone, and I've been around a lot of situations, so out of it. I mean, absolutely had no idea of what he was doing, where he was acting really, really strangely. And it was just a very difficult situation. They dealt with it very well. But then the A&E staff, a nurse was, you know, tasked with having to sit by his bedside for a couple of hours until he came out of it.
And then another call, Brian, a young woman this time, again, too much drink.
We got a call from a member of a stag group, someone they either met or was a tour guide for them. It wasn't very clear, had collapsed near Temple Bar. She was on the ground when we arrived. This is in and around midnight at this stage, or a little bit afterwards, Sean. And she had a fancy dress type costume on, and again, it was quite cold.
We have an unconscious girl there on Vaughan Street, upper.
EMT Alpha 1, we're mobile for same. People have now gotten to that 6-7 hour stage of drinking copious amounts of alcohol. The parties are getting louder and people are starting to drop. So we're coming into the busy time of the night.
So yeah, we've arrived at scene here with the ambulance, and we have found a female unconscious, unresponsive. So we're going to remove her off the street. Right, so our patient is starting to vomit, so we're going to have to roll her over, make sure her airway is clear. So obvious smell of Sambuca there, and quite a large amount of vomit, emesis, as we call it, on the floor now at this stage.
She's, as we call, C2H5OH, which is intoxicated. And she's alone. She's wearing a small costume. And she's unconscious and unresponsive.
Dangerous situation.
On a city street. Yeah, and a side street in the city at that, too. As it happens, there was somebody else who came along in the meantime to establish who she was, so we've managed to ascertain some details on this girl.
We've finished up that scene now.
I did hear some of the people who were with her saying there was a free shots promotion somewhere and she had taken at least seven.
Yeah, as I said, there was a sizable quantity of emesis, which was
vomit,
pretty much, yeah, vomit, and which was very pungent, smelling of a particular brand, and it was in a raw state. And we've just been told anecdotally from the people who were with her, they acquired 15 free shots for this young lady. The potential danger with that is where she's vomited. She hasn't had good control of her airway. We managed to maintain that for her. We rolled her into what we call the recovery position, and we allowed her to vomit. We allowed her to expel all of that emesis. And now she's actually come around. She's after stating her name for us. So she's back, if you like, in the land of the living.
So a third of the total living space there under the receiver's Grant Thornton. Tenants have been living in this complex all through this period.
Yeah, it's a very desirable location, very close to Blackrock. It's also close to the new IT hub in Mahon Point in Cork, where you'd have many workers, especially workers from outside of Ireland, would be employed. One tenant told me he estimated the split between single persons and families is about 70-30. So rent for a three-bedroom apartment was in and around €1,000 per month. But in recent weeks, some tenants have been told that there's to be a sale of some of the units and they've been given 8 weeks to leave their properties. I met one man yesterday, Celso Lomas. He's a Brazilian father of two. He's lived in Eden for 5 years and he heard rumours that something was happening after Christmas, but he found it hard to get information.
They wouldn't give me information. They would give bits and pieces here, but I had to leave because I got a letter.
When did you get the letter?
Me to late January. And we were given the, I believe, it's statutory 8 weeks to leave the properties. And there wasn't much negotiation whatsoever, no, for any sign of it. Just a crude letter saying, please leave by the 18th of March.
And had you any indication that this was coming down the tracks? Like, did you know that there was uncertainty around the ownership of the property that you were staying in?
No, everything was going as normal. I had just received, asked to raise the rent.
When was that request made to raise the rent?
Mid-2015.
And how much extra did the rent go up?
25%.
So midway through last year, you're told your rent has gone up 25%. You think, okay, not nice. You'd no other choice. And then suddenly you get a letter in January telling you to be out by the 18th of March.
Correct, yes.
The tenants I met last week were very frustrated at having to leave their properties, but also at not being given a chance to buy the properties before they went on the market or to remain in place paying rent and paying the same rent that they're paying, essentially. So there was a lot of additional media coverage during the course of the week after our report, and the actions created huge uncertainty for all those other tenants in Eden who were in properties controlled by Grant Thornton. There's a meeting call for this Wednesday night. Some local TDs were urging tenants not to leave, and the group has begun to mobile itself on social media.
Right. Now, in the meantime, you've got news of a change. I won't say a change of heart, but a change of approach by the receivers.
Yeah, I've seen a copy of a letter sent by Grant Thornton last Friday to tenants in the other properties they control in Eden. Now, the letter references the recent media coverage. It confirms that the initial 35 units are still to be sold. But crucially, in relation to the remaining properties, Grant Thornton now say that there will be no more sales in 2016. So it'll be 2017 at the earliest before any of the other properties are sold. And this is a big change, they say it's the intention now of Grant Thornton to sell the remaining properties with the tenancies in place. And it says in the letter, and I quote, please be assured that your tenancy is not affected.
Right, so this is a different commitment, Brian, isn't it, to the one given to the tenants that you spoke to last week?
Completely different. And those I spoke to last week, they were given their statutory 8 weeks notice, I think it was. There was very little explanation as to what was happening in the background or why. It's obviously very good news, Sean, for the tenants in the remaining 90 or so units who were very concerned. I met one of them yesterday.
we heard, you know, our friends, they got the notes, so we were worried as well.
You thought she would be next.
Yes, we were wondering, will we get one as well? And, you know, like, especially having small baby, we didn't know we will have home in next 6 months.
You didn't know where you'd be in 6 months' time.
Yes,
and with a small baby, that's hard.
Yeah.
So now you've got a letter from Grant Thornton saying
now
what?
We've got a letter saying we can stay in place in 2016. We don't know what's going to happen next, but it's a big relief now that we know we can stay now in place and we don't have to leave.
First, though, to an exclusive from our reporter Brian O'Connell on radicalisation here in Ireland. Our security forces do monitor suspected ISIS sympathisers, and there have been allegations that up to 40 people from Ireland are fighting with ISIS. But Brian, you've been looking into this and have really come across some quite disturbing information about what's happening here now. Just to warn listeners, during the course of this report, you will be hearing some voice distortion. It was essential to protect our interviewee. So, Brian, tell us, what did you find?
Well, I've met with a number of people, Keelan, who have concerns that within a section of the Muslim community here in Ireland, some people are being radicalised. Now, we're obviously not going to say where in Ireland this is happening, but one person I met now believes that a person known to her has left Ireland to try and fight with ISIS after being radicalised here in Ireland. She believes also, Keelan, that authorities here, that they're not doing enough, she feels, to monitor radicals coming here to Ireland from abroad. And these are coming here to deliver lectures, to deliver talks, and that much of this, much of what's happening is behind closed doors. It's in different languages, and she feels it's gone completely undetected. Now, as you said, we've disguised this person's voice to help protect their identity. And first of all, she spoke to me about what she's been noticing amongst a certain community here and what they are teaching young people in classes.
For the last 2 years in certain places, I can see the difference between now that I can see that plenty of negativity and plenty of radicalism in the society with different meaning and interpretation for the Islam, which doesn't reflect it.
Do you think there are some people here forming a more radical interpretation of Islam?
Yeah, definitely. And especially that not just here, they are getting people from abroad, inviting them into the Irish society, not the Irish society mainly, but into the Muslim society, just to like to preach more about Islam, but in a different way, in a very radical way.
The people who are giving these more radical talks and classes, who are they or where are they from, do you know?
All what I know is that there will be people from the UK, some of them coming from Saudi Arabia, and they will be spending certain time of period of time in the mosque or around the mosque area, or they will take a theme about Islam in Arabic or in their own language, it depends.
Now, somebody you know who is quite young was in one of these classes, and some of what you heard him say afterwards was very concerning.
Yeah, he mentioned that the people said to him, oh, well, you are going to be a really good ninja. And I said to him, what do you mean by ninja? Is it because of your haircut? And he said, no, just if I'm wearing black, I have my hair, and I can kill all the bad people. Who are the bad people? Oh, the Christians, I say. You're going to kill the Christian in the Christian country. What are you talking about? This is jihadist in the house. If you want to be a good Muslim, doesn't need to be killing yourself or to be a jihadist.
Yeah, if you remember, just to recap, I said that the man had been in Ireland over a decade, Sean, having married an Irish woman initially. They separated and he remarried a Syrian woman. Now, she has been living in Syria with his son, but 3 months ago he was able to reunite his family under a government reunification scheme, and he was able to bring his wife and son to Ireland. Now, the agency NOSC have been able to help them and they're now living in Cork City. But since coming here 3 months ago, Sean, he says his wife has been subjected to almost daily abuse and harassment. He's talking here about why they left Syria in the first place.
My house, in, you know, destroy her. Or my wife's house, destroy, you know. My cousin, my neighbors, my, you know, all the area in the village, the house is damaged. I have my brother for last year. They take him to prison for 10 days and they kill him by torture.
Torture,
yeah. And I have three cousins, they get killed in the prison.
So you've organized for your wife and son to come to Ireland. How have they been since they come here?
Seriously, no, my wife, she say if I'm dying in Syria, better than me, like, you know, this the situation by racism is very, very hard for her. She miscarriage last week from this They knock on the door every time. They frighten her. They shouting when I am not at home. They shouting on the door. They throwing rocks, you know. That about last week, she miscarried from this situation.
Sorry to hear that.
She was pregnant, you know. She was only 5 weeks, was pregnant. And they knock on the door. They bring laser on the window, you know.
And you've lived here for 13 years. Did you have those kinds of incidents?
I have too many. But now getting worse.
Why do you think that is?
Because my wife, she have a veil.
You're a Muslim?
Yeah, Muslim. She have a veil. And this area, I think, they're not used to see something like this. Because it's, I don't know, strange for them, I think. That's what, when they saw her, they keep staring at her, you know.
Are you seriously telling me your wife thinks it would have been better to be back in Syria in the war?
The way she feel is not really, is, you know, that's more feeling than truth, you know, more feeling. Every 2 or 3 days, they throw rubbish in my garden. They say a very bad word for me, very, very bad word. And one neighbor, he tell me, go home to your country. You rats, you this, you that, you know. All the, I don't want to say it on the radio, you know.
You went up, Brian, to the front gate, I gather, with the former resident from whom we heard earlier.
That's right. And the closer we got, Sean, the more I could see the apprehension and tension on her face, even though it was, as I said, 40 years since she was a resident there. And I suppose because so much of it is intact, the memories of it, the landmarks on the site, they all quickly became flooding back to her.
I remember going through there. As a big door going in. It's kind of the 3 steps up into it.
And where did you stay then when you were here?
At the back.
And describe what it was like.
Torture, the work in there. We were so tired at night going to bed, you know what I mean? And then up at six or half six in the morning, scrub the floors before you even get your breath, and then march into church for prayers. You know, and then down to work, then might get bread and dripping, or bread and stock margarine, or a cup of cocoa. For breakfast in the morning. They've ruined our lives. The thing I'll bring to my death, all these melting laundries. On my deathbed, I'll be thinking about it.
Did you ever sit down with any of the order afterwards and try and...
No.
Did you ever get an apology?
No, I never forgive them. I found it very hard when I went out into the outside world. I'd been locked up in the convent for 16 years. 16 years, and then send you out to the world, you know what I mean? And then throw you into a melting laundry then. Nobody cared about us. Nobody wanted us. We were nobody. And sometimes now, when I was down at home on my own, I found it very lonely, you know. I've all the time thinking back and begin to think now that I am somebody, you know what I mean? I'm not on my own. I can get help and I can somebody to talk to.
And her experience in the system obviously had a huge impact on her life. She suffered from mental health issues, but as she said there, she's in a pretty good place now. She has supports around her. And I suppose that's allowed her to go back and visit the site. We also walked, that was at the front of the building, and we also walked around to the other side of the building. And she remembered the first day when she was brought there, and she didn't actually realise where she was.
I thought it was a school, you know what I mean, or something like that, that you're going to be taught. And then they said, well, you put you down here as the laundry. I said, laundry. So I went down and did the laundry.
You're in your late teens at this stage, 18, 19?
Yeah, I say so, yeah.
Did you get paid at the end of the first week?
Never got paid.
The end of the second week?
Never got paid.
Did you ask for money?
No, wouldn't give it to you. They wouldn't give it to you.
Are these buildings familiar to you? Can you remember them?
Well, when I see it now, it's only the back here.
Yeah.
When I see it, I might remember it.
So we're just looking in through the locked gates here.
That could be the laundry part there. That there be the boiler house, I'd say. Yeah, because I remember the boiler house. We used to go in there and smoke turf and newspaper.
And in here, you think, was the laundry?
I think in there was the laundry, yeah.
Yeah.
We're never allowed to talk to each other. Even the dorms that night, we're never allowed to talk. We had no education. I mean, they took away my childhood. I was just traumatised.
You mentioned electroshock treatment earlier.
I did, I got electric shocks, yeah. I went to commit suicide. When I came out all the convents, I took overdose tablets and everything. Thinking back and all this would happen to me, do you know what I mean? Why my mother left me, do you know? Why she put me into a place?
Did you ever reconcile it with your mother afterwards?
No, I'm looking. No, I'm looking. Still looking since I was 19.
You don't know where she is?
No. No. And I asked the nuns, who are the likes of you? So.
Say that again?
I asked the nuns, where's my mother? Who are the likes of you? That's what I was told.
And how do you feel looking in over the gate here now at this property that's for sale? We know it was run as a Magdalene laundry up until 1992, and then it was run as a commercial laundry up until 2006, and now it's for sale. But a lot of what you remember would still be inside there.
I say so. The big troughs for washing the clothes and the corridors and the dormitories. Do you know what I mean? I say it's all there.
What do you think should happen to the site? There's an argument being made that part of it should be preserved, or that some of the artefacts in there should be handed over to the state. Do you think it's a part of Irish history that people want to forget about?
I'd never forget about it. You couldn't forget about a thing like that.